To see examples of what we talk about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction. I'm Don Moore, and you're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast of no direction. And sitting across from me is a man who has a story behind him, but refuses to tell what it is.
You got that right.
It's Mr.
Mr. Al. Yep, I refuse to tell the story. You'll have to read about it in my autobiography.
If you listen to every single episode we've done, he always gives you little clues, just a little scratch of the surface, but you're never going to get all the way through.
You never figure it out, because you don't know whether I'm lying or not.
That's what keeps me bringing me back for more.
That's right. I'm a man of mystery. And we're here to talk about
comic books. There you go.
It seems like you've read some. I have not.
Here's a funny story. You know, after last episode, our friend Dan Pritchard down in Australia, we were talking about dollar boxes, and I just mentioned to him that, you know, I saw some, I asked him if he had picked up, he was always interested in Miracle Man, you know, Alan Moore, you know, Gary Leach and Alan Davis and many other series. And, at one point, we were talking about them. I told him that Marvel was putting them out again. And he got interested. He looked them up. And I just asked if he had gotten them all. I figured he'd just buy the trades. And he says, no, he was missing some. And then he was teasing me because I saw a couple of issues at Nerd Out Comics in the dollar box. And since I have all the old Eclipse issues from the 80s, I just never bothered. Marvel was putting them out. And Alan Davis has done all the covers I saw, which, you know, I like, because I liked Alan Davis. I never bothered to buy any. But they look like nice packages. One time, Paul Grist made a comment. I guess, even though he was familiar with the series and read it all, one of the first issues they had, it starts out with a woman. I think it's the guy that becomes Miracle Man. I can't remember his name, but his wife was taking a shower. And, you know, in the original series, she was naked. And Marvel drew a black underwear over her or something like that. And, you know, he said, yeah, well, I mean, you know, you expect it. It's a Marvel comic. But he said, he couldn't help but notice that. Says, don't they realize what happens later on in the series? A lot of horrifying things that happen later on in the series.
This is the original series? Or the
yeah.
Series? Oh, okay. Yeah.
No, the one Alan Moore and... You know, Marvel Man, was it Kid Marvel Man? Horrible things happen to him when, you know, the boy comes back. Besides all the destroying and decapitating and everything, there's some horrendous stuff, but that's all I knew about it. Well, anyway, I found Miracle Man 3 in the dollar box at Wilson's.
Is that from last year or something?
I'm guessing. Because I'm guessing the series finished. And it's really thick. I was surprised. It's the stuff that they printed from Eclipse.
This is old stuff.
Yeah, it's the Alan Moore series.
I thought they were doing new material.
They might be.
Interesting.
But
okay.
What Dan was interested in was the Alan Moore stuff. But the reason I'm talking about this now, you know, I picked it up and thumbed through it, and the second half of the story is the Warp Smiths, which I guess ran in Warrior Magazine. I never read it, but I was surprised, because in the Miracle Man series, at one point, they have the Warp Smiths show up, like in a panel or two, which fascinated me, and they were observing and manipulating, and it is fascinating, because I wanted to know more. Come to find out, it was a series, and this thing is kind of put together like a DVD set, because it's got back matter, you know, sketches of the Warp Smith and designs that they did. It has notes. It has some original artwork pages. And then it has the whole, you know, the story on the Warp Smiths, and explain it about, you know, how they showed up in Miracle Man and what they were doing. That's nice. Dan sent me a list of the issues he's missing, but they're later issues. But when we go back, I'm going to start pulling some of these Miracle Man.
There was more of them at Wilson's?
No, I looked. I didn't see any more. But there was, I think I saw two or three issues at Nerd Out Comics. I don't know what the number
Did you ever find out the Love and Rockets thing from last week when we went out looking? Is it out yet? Do you even know?
I don't know. I haven't seen it.
That's weird. If anybody is listening to the show knows, please Facebook us and let Don know.
Cause well, I'm going to have to order it online. You would think Yancey would have it. They have everything else.
They might.
I haven't seen Cave Carson, but I just got a...
You could always call him.
I got an issue of Doom Patrol, and they open it up as a spread and just talk about all the young DC Young Animal books, and they have it in there and all these reviews.
They would probably have it at Yancey Street, yeah.
Yeah, I imagine. But no, I haven't seen it at Wilson's or Nerd Out, but they had all the other ones.
Well, Wilson's wouldn't necessarily like just put one for the shelf without having a subscriber, I don't think.
Well, they've done that with Doom Patrol, and they've done that for Shade the Changing Girl.
But they wouldn't. Who publishes the new Love and Rockets?
Fantagraphics. Now, I ordered that from the store. I told the guy, but
okay.
I don't know. Either he just didn't get it, or you know, I'm gonna have to.
Maybe it's not out yet, man. You know, I mean, we'll look it up during the break and see what it says.
I will say one thing. It seems to me like if you're going to do a magazine, you're just killing yourself, because I don't see magazines in any of the comic stores anymore. I see trades.
Stores never liked magazines because they don't fit in the comic book box. I'm just saying that. I don't know if that's
true. I remember in the 70s and 80s, you used to see all kinds of Starlog and heavy metal and stuff.
Yeah, that was like in the 70s and 80s. I mean, since like the 90s, they don't like magazines at all. It's everything's got to be in comic book format. Well, whatever. I mean, there's not that many magazines out anymore. I did finally find the issue number 8 of The Creeps at Barnes & Noble after like 4 attempts. So there's a magazine. It's a good, it's a creepy, you know, style magazine. It's very good. I haven't read it yet, but I will talk about it next week. It's got a nice Kenneth Smith cover. $5-6. Yeah, there you go. There's a magazine there. And there's a few horror mags, but yeah, black and white. People don't generally like black and white magazines. You know, remember all this creepy, eerie Conan, all that stuff. They don't really care for that anymore. And I think even Fangoria is out of business now. So a lot of that stuff is, see ya. You know, it's too bad.
I always read Love and Rockets. It's always been in black and white.
Now, is a new one going to be a comic book or a magazine?
That's what we're talking about, magazine.
Oh, maybe that's why you're not seeing it.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought they were going to comic book form.
No.
Oh, I forgot. Oh.
No, because
I don't think it's going to be in the stores.
Because I asked the guy in Nerd Out if he had it, and he had a sympathetic no. Like, he had no intention to order it, I guess.
Hmm.
But like I said, I subscribed to it, and I still haven't seen it. So, I don't know.
It'll come out. You'll get it. It'll be available at some point. Yeah. If not, look on Amazon. They may even have it there already. You know? So it's going to be a quarterly magazine like it used to be then.
That's what they're saying.
Probably because the other books, the hardcovers or the softcovers, the format didn't take or something like that.
Well, that was, again, I never saw them in stores. Britt told me that they were, you know, when it started coming out, so people say it's good. They returned to form. And I kept telling the store I went to at the time, I wanted it, okay. I want it, okay. I want it, okay. I want it, okay. And, I mean, months. And finally, I said, look, I can pay for it now if you can order if that helps. And then the guy immediately ordered it, and I got it the next week.
Oh, at Wilson's?
No.
Oh.
No, but...
At Shecky's?
That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But then the second time... I wanted, you know, the second issue came out a year later, and I went through the same thing, and I got tired of it, and finally I just looked it up online, saw they had it, you know, and thought, okay, so ever since then, I just bought it online. It's easier.
And sadly, but true.
You know, I would order it through the store, but, you know, when you get a book that comes out every year, I mean, that's okay,
yeah.
But getting a magazine online is kind of a pain, and, you know, it can be expensive, but...
It might not be out yet. Who knows? You would think, but who knows?
You know, when 11 Rockets first came out, it was the same way. I remember Fantagraphics for...
Did you buy the first issue?
Yeah, I got it. But I got it... In 82, when I was in college, Fantagraphics on all the publications ran that first issue cover saying, coming, coming, coming. And I always saw it black and white. At one point, I told a friend, this looks really good. And he said, yeah, I saw it in color. And he said, the colors are really neat on it. And then later, I started seeing on, you know, published on the back of Comic Journal and stuff in color. Man. Well, in Oklahoma, I was talking to another guy, and he said that he got the first issue. Really? The store I went to didn't have it. And he said that store he got it from, it sold out right away. Oh, man. Well, then I joined the Navy and go to California, went to San Diego, and they had a stack of them.
That's where they're from.
Yeah, well, yeah, they're from Los Angeles, but the store I found in San Diego, it was one of the stores that had everything. It had Japanese comics, French comics, underground comics, mainstream comics. If it was comic related, they had it, which was awesome. That's how it should be. And after that, I was able to get every issue of Love and Rockets. And, it was great fun, but eventually they started coming out, and you started picking them up everywhere. But that's after.
There it is on eBay. Love and Rockets number one, 2016. Heroes variant, whatever that means.
Yeah, it's a different cover than the run I always see.
It's a different cover. So does that mean it came out already? I'm assuming.
Yeah, I think it's been out.
Oh, that stinks. Well, you can get it. It's going to cost you like $4 shipping. Now you can get it on eBay.
Yeah.
You'll wait. I got you. The cover looks nice.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're great. You know, like I said, and after a while, Fantagraphics had a bunch of those kind of books. They had Love and Rockets. They had Lloyd Llewellyn by Dan Klaus. They had Threat by Four Guys. They had Hate by Peter Bagg. And, Or no, Neat Stuff by Peter Bagg. There was like, you know, six to eight of those big magazines. And I always thought a missed opportunity, and I don't know if they ever tried it or if it would have worked, but, you know, that was back in the 80s when record stores were everywhere, especially like the little neighborhood record stores. And I always thought it'd be smart if they just had a little tiny, you know, rack by the cash register that had those books, because people that were into music love those books. And I thought, you know, hey, there's a comic here. I'll buy this, too. And it was a perfect format for it. You know, it was a magazine. And when I'd ever mentioned it, people said, well, people go in to buy records. They're only going to put their money to records. Well, then why do they sell wallets and cards and everything else on the planet, Rolling Stone and Musician Magazine and everything else in those places, plus blank tape and everything else? I think they would have sold, but, I mean, I'm not a retailer with any history of it, but to me, it would have made sense if they would have sold those in there, because that was the audience for it.
Punk rock, you mean?
Well, the music, I mean, I was never punk rock, but I
no,
loved it.
No, I mean, they had the punk rock thing going on.
Yeah, well, Love and Rockets had the music thing, but all those books were kind of fun and quirky. Everybody in my brother's band, my brother loved Lloyd Llewellyn. That was his favorite comic.
Really?
And, everybody he played with, hey, can I read that? You know, and they'd always make references to Lloyd Llewellyn. So I don't know. I just always thought that those black and white magazines Fantagraphics had would have been perfect for record stores. But
yeah, you know, I mean, I rarely see magazines at Yancey, new ones. I usually see back issues a little bit. As a matter of fact, one time we went there, they had a box of magazines, and he actually wrote on it, these are large size comics, like as if you didn't know what a magazine was.
But you're looking at spectacles from our generation. I mean, you come from a later generation. Wait a minute, what?
What's this? It's a larger size comic book. Wow!
That's like when we grow up, every time I'd buy one of those 50 cent, you know, 100 page spectaculars, every single time, the clerk. 50 cents? I remember when these things were a dime. Well, yeah, but it was a different generation. They were never a dime when I was a kid.
If they still make magazines, you go to Barnes & Noble, there's magazines, but, you know, I mean, you have to explain it to people, I guess, you know, holy moly, they actually make them in a different size. Oh my gosh, and whatever. So, but It's out. You might want to call Barnes & Noble or somebody like that. They carry. I haven't seen it. I've been to it. Barnes & Noble does carry some comic books, you know, like below the magazines, but I haven't seen it there, so I have no idea. But it's definitely out, so you should scour the newsstands. There's no newsstands around here. No, it wouldn't be a newsstand either. Back when they had newsstands, you'd have a lot of magazines. Magazines used to be king, man, back in, you know, back when the people drew with stone tablets and chisels and hammers or whatever.
Well, it was different ways to get information at the time, but they're not really that necessary anymore, I guess. I really enjoyed them
still, but yeah.
And
they're expensive.
When you used to go to convenience stores, they always had a big magazine, even in the 90s. And they had a big magazine section, and now you go into them and they have maybe five. And they're always kind of the slick fashion magazines. And they all kind of look the same. It used to be each one had a different design and different perspective.
Yeah, yeah, art direction or whatever.
It's just like newspapers. The St. Petersburg Times down here was second to none. The graphics were fantastic. The sections, it was an incredible newspaper. My father worked at a newspaper in Oklahoma City, or the only newspaper there. And when he'd see this one, he'd go, man, you guys got a really unique paper. And now it looks just like everybody else's. It's nothing but AP wire and stuff they get from the New York Times, and kind of generic, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's not that many newspapers left in the country, you know. I mean, major ones anyway. Maybe each state has one, maybe two, mm-hmm. maybe. I don't know.
Well, one thing that killed them, which I wasn't expecting, was the classified ads is where they're making a lot of money.
Now you got the internet.
Yeah, you know, when you had to sell something or announce something or, you know, jobs. You found jobs for the classifieds, the jobs advertised.
Yeah, I did.
But it was $12 for so many words. And some of those classified ads. When I lived in L.A., I was looking at the classifieds, and my friend said, hey, you want a way to make a lot of money? And he pointed this huge classified ad that I saw every single day for Super Password. You know, Los Angeles, they record all the game shows. But yeah. So you could earn up to $25,000, and they had the logo for Super Password.
Oh, you should have gone, man. You would have been on TV, yeah. Maybe.
But I was laughing about it. This is, yeah, I see this every day. My friend laughed. My friend actually went on a game show after I left.
No kidding.
And, when my wife and I got married and then we moved away, he was on a show called Crosswits. And I can't remember what one guy was. It was a big comedian. He was on a lot of 70s shows.
Big as in heavy or popular?
I think he was on Rockford Files, McMillan and Wife. He was the big,
Oh, John Shuck?
I might have been. He was the I guess, some type of police detective that sometimes worked with McMillan.
We'll look that up. I think it might have been John Shuck, because I know on Rockford Files it was Stuart Margolin.
No, it wasn't Rockford Angel. Files. No, I think it was McMillan and Wife.
Well, look him up.
I may be wrong, but Jimmy was telling me about
it. He was his partner or
something?
Yeah,
he said he was the one that he took into the pit. I never saw Crosswits. I don't know what it was. He says, I said, where's he from? So I think he said McMillan and Wife. He was telling me on the phone, and he said, or was it he, I said, yeah, he was really nice. As a matter of fact, I took him to the pit. What's the pit? Well, I guess like 25,000 pyramid or something where you choose somebody and go
your
in.
Your buddy was on that, the 25,000 pyramid?
No,
I don't
Crosswits.
Know what the pit is.
Crosswits. I never saw
Crosswits.
Crosswits.
I keep thinking, okay, Crosswits.
But he
once
said,
again, we'll find out.
But he went on Crosswits, and he won a trip to Hawaii. I remember Jimmy said, I guess when he had called to get the tickets, he brought his dad with him. And I remember the girl said, wow, nice son. But, you know, Jimmy was always wanting to go on a game show. He watched them. He was fascinated.
You know, one time when I went to Disney, I think it was Disney. It was either Disney or Epcot. They were actually shooting, like, I don't think it was a real one, but they were shooting, like, a simulation of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And we actually went in and we were sitting in the audience. And, you know, they called some guy out and there was a woman there, a hostess, and they did like a simulation of a show. It was really interesting. You know, the person, I don't think the person won anything, but it was kind of fun, like, to be in the game show world for like a little while anyway. Yeah, in Burbank, that's where they did all of them.
Yeah, you know, all like, those shows.
Including the Tonight Show, with, you know, and all that stuff. That was Burbank or whatever, but Crosswits, I forgot about that show. You know, that's not on the Game Show Network.
They only have
Match Game, and you know what others do? You know, from local channels, from the over-the-air channels, you know, the digital one, there's another game show channel called Buzzer that you can get, and they got like Tattletales, and then at night they play like black and white ones for people that you forgot about from a million years ago. You know, talk about a million years ago, you know, or like everybody's like, you know, wearing like suits and ties and, you know, fashion gowns and all that stuff, or whatever. Kitty Carlisle and all that stuff.
Oh, she was wonderful. You know, she was an actress. I didn't know that.
I thought she was a professional contestant or whatever.
The reason why I always wondered was because...
Please, tell me about Kitty Carlisle.
No, she was on To Tell the Truth. You know, when they brought it back in the 70s?
Oh, yeah?
And, you know, she was an older woman then, but she just... You couldn't help but be enamored by her. And my mom and one of her friends were talking about her. And they were saying something about her background. They didn't say she was an actress, but she... They said that's the reason she's on the show, but I guess she was, like, in... I don't know what you call the upper echelon. She went to all the parties and stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
she was a debutante or a socialite.
Yeah, socialite. But there was a story to her, and they said that's why they have her on the show. And that TV show from the 80s, or excuse me, the 90s, Mad About You.
Yeah.
They were talking about, I guess the main character's cousin was dating a girl. She said she was one of the original Go-Go's in the band, which wasn't true. And she also said she was a stand-in for one of the John F. Kennedy's daughters. And I remember the main guy said, there's no way. Because she was on To Tell the Truth, and she was one of the girls that was supposed to be Kennedy's daughter, you know. To Tell the Truth was a show where three people would come out, and they'd say, I am Al Val. I am Al Val. I am Al Val.
Yeah, right.
And then the four contestants have to ask questions the whole time, and at the end... they have to choose who the real Al Val is. And then finally they say, well, the real Al Val, please stand up.
And they all, like, pretend, like, oh,
yeah,
wow,
and
yeah.
Then one does. It was a show I liked, and I guess it was on way earlier than that, but I remember Bill Cullen was on it.
Bill Cullen, yeah.
And Kitty Carlisle and a woman named Peggy. I can't remember the other guy.
Peggy, she was a redheaded woman.
Oh,
yeah.
And the other guy was Gene...
not Gene Rayburn. Was
yeah, it was Gene Rayburn.
Gene Rayburn
what was it, Match Game?
Yeah, Match Game, the sleazy Match Game.
Yeah, but this was before Match Game he was on it. But by this time in the early 70s, Kitty Carlisle was still pretty, but she was an older woman.
Sure, yeah.
But very classy. And I just found out she was in some old movies. And
I didn't know that.
I think I saw it on... I've been watching a lot of Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah.
And it was Turner Classic Movies, in all black and white, and she was just wonderful.
So Crosswits, it was a tic-tac-toe game.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah, that's it, right here. There's some images for the show right there, you know?
Okay. I've never seen the show. When I moved here to Tampa, one of the guys on our ship lived in Tampa. We were on St. Pete. But I told Dave, I says, yeah, Jimmy Wiseman was on Crosswits. And he's like... I thought I was going to have to explain to him like I did to you. And he goes, he was on Crosswits? And he started laughing. He knew the show. But they didn't show it in any town I had lived in. And
that's
I think
funny.
It was,
one of the words was pecker. That's nice. So it's like a scramble or a tic-tac-toe. Or they're like, yeah, like a whatchamacallit, a crossword puzzle or something like that.
All Crosswits.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that's funny. Okay, so your buddy won like a Hawaii trip. He must have been good at it.
I guess so. He liked to watch game shows. He was always...
I did too, actually. When I was a kid, we all watched them in the mornings.
See, I don't. My wife watched them.
I used to watch them.
I've seen them. I mean, I've watched them, but I never really watched them with great interest. My wife likes them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like them anymore.
But when I say that, I wouldn't go on Super Password because I could tell you I would look moronic if I went on.
Remember, I got a secret. I got a secret where, like, somebody comes out and, you know, they just write their name and then, like, you don't know what they did something. You know, like, and so, say some guy you never saw, you never know, shows up, he writes his name. You're in my name is so-and-so. And then, like, when he sits down, they tell the host a secret, and it's like, whatever, because I invented the atomic bomb or whatever. And then the panel has to ask him questions and try to figure it out. You never saw that one before? Right, I've got a secret. Right. Yeah, that's a good one. Oh, look, there's Kitty Carlisle right there. She must have been around in the 30s or something like that. Wow. Let's see what movie she was in.
Oh, Night at the Opera. That's why I had the DVD. It was the Marx Brothers. And she was the main protagonist. And she could sing. That was Kitty. And I was watching, that's how I remember it. I was watching the audio commentary, and they were telling the story about Kitty Carlisle.
She didn't do that many movies.
No.
More theater than movies.
But, I mean, like I said, she was wonderful on... Now, I forgot the name of that stupid show.
Mad About
To Tell
You.
The Truth.
She was always on To Tell the Truth.
Yeah, but she was wonderful in The Marx Brothers.
Kitty is a nickname for Catherine, which I didn't figure that out. Well, that's kind of cool, man. So now we have images of Kitty Carlisle now, too. Well, we have taken such a direction on this show. We're talking about Kitty Carlisle and game shows and... We have definitely gone off in no direction, so
yeah,
but it's good though. I like it. I like it. We're not repeating ourselves on this show, you know.
So we repeat ourselves all the time.
Yeah, well, you know, she's still. Oh no, she died. She died in 2007. She was 98 years old.
Wow,
that's a damn good run.
Yeah, it seems to me like she always had a good life. She was a classy person, and Night at the Opera with the Marx Brothers. You can't go wrong, and she's in it. So
and speaking of, sadly, the Man from U.N.C.L.E. passed away this week.
Yeah, Robert Vaughn.
Robert Vaughn and the great singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen. So, rough week, man. Rough week.
I'll be honest with you. I thought those guys were gone before.
Robert Vaughn, no. Did I ever tell you my Robert Vaughn story, what happened?
No.
This is like in the 90s. We were at a convention. It was in South Florida. And it was like, this guy put it on. It was like... celebrities, but mostly it was like Playboy Playmates, but ones that are around for a while, so, you know, they looked okay, but it wasn't like the magazine. You know, anyway, so that was the convention where I didn't get to see Basil Gogos.
Oh, yeah.
That one. So Robert Vaughn's supposed to be there, right? So I'm looking around, I see all these people, I'm like, okay, you know, I know Robert Vaughn. So finally I hook up with my friends at the front of the place, and I go, yeah, I saw this one here, but I haven't seen Robert Vaughn. Where the hell is Robert Vaughn? Have you seen Robert Vaughn? I've never seen him. All of a sudden, I hear, I'm right here! And I go, oh, hi! You know, and he was just sitting there like, you know, hey, idiot, I'm right here. You know, get a new pair of glasses or whatever. I'm like, oh, hi, and I'm not going to buy your autograph or anything, but, you know. But he yelled at me, so that's my Robert Vaughn story. Still like him. He wasn't being mean. He was just like, hey, idiot, I'm right here. Open your eyes. You know?
Did you go talk to him or anything?
No, he was autographing for people. You know?
Well, then why did you care if he's going to be there or not?
I just wanted to see the Man from U.N.C.L.E. You know, I wanted to see him there. I go, oh, look, I saw the Man from U.N.C.L.E. You know, I wasn't going to pay $25 for an autograph. I never do that. Sadly, I should, but I never really do. I'll talk to him and say hi or whatever, but he was with a bunch of people. And he was just like, and I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. You know, I'll go talk to some playmate from 1957 or whatever. You know who was there too? The woman. Oh God, what was her name? She was in The Monster from Piedras Blancas. Remember that movie, The Monster from Piedras Blancas? He was like, kind of like a Creature from the Black Lagoon knockoff. If you see the picture, you remember him. Yeah. What was her name? Now I'm PO'd. She actually had. One of those Hollywood documentaries, because apparently she was in a lot of the magazines, you know, in the 50s, but she had affairs with all sorts of famous people, like Sinatra and all that stuff, you know. And I gotta look up her name. We'll talk about it after the break or whatever, but yeah, she was there. But the dude that put on the show, I think his name was Ray Quartz, he doesn't do them anymore. He was pissed because he didn't do that much advertising. He just figured people were gonna show up and there was nobody there.
Well, that's a mistake.
There was nobody there, and he was really angry. We were talking to him, and he's like, I'll never do a show in this town again, you know, that nobody showed up. And I'm like, did you do any advertising? Well, I was on a couple of radio shows, and I'm like, dude. So it was one of these guys that had a reputation in California because he was famous. He's from Florida, but he did a lot of California shows.
Yeah.
And over there, it's like, you know, you don't probably don't have to do any advertising. They're on every hotel, you know, like every weekend or whatever. Here, down there, it didn't do well, so.
It sounds like he networks a lot in California. And it seemed like, the thing is, the only experience I have is we've done seminars at the school. You know, we bring in a practitioner from another place. But I'll tell you, you've got to get the word out any way you can.
And, God, yeah.
Yeah, you got to, you know, tell other schools. You got to mention it everywhere. You got to send out flyers. You got to get on message boards if you're online. Send out emails.
This is pre-internet, too, by the way.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I mean, I'm just saying, I'm talking about my experience. But
Now you can do it on the internet and everybody will know.
We had seminars when the internet wasn't what it is now, and most people weren't on it.
Jeannie Carmen is the name of the woman, by the way. Look her up.
We print up flyers, and, you know, every time we go to the tournaments, even seminars, we pass everything out. They'd announce it to everybody. We'd mail them out, anything we could. And I remember one time I was putting one together, and I got very little response before the seminar. And I'm thinking, geez, you know, because you have to pay this guy to come out and everything. And I'm just thinking, I don't know. And then I was talking to one guy that called and said he was coming and bringing some students. And, you know, we got talking. He says, you know, I guess he felt for me. He was asking how I was going. And, you know, I told him, and he says, listen, I went through the same thing every time I had a seminar. And at the last minute, you're thinking nobody's going to show. He says, but they do. And he was right. They did. And sometimes not as many as you want, but, you know, it covers your cost, and, you know, they leave happy. But yeah, you gotta get the word out.
Good old Jeannie Carmen.
Yeah, I've seen her.
Yeah, you've seen her in some movies. Yeah. Huh. Yeah, she was notorious, man. She was hot too. She still looked good back then, you know, when she was at the show. But she did a lot of. She was, like I said, remember the E! True Hollywood Story or those things like that. Yeah. There was a couple. It was one of those about her or whatever. But it was interesting. Let me see if I can find the monster from Piedras Blancas. So, you know, that's another cool guy or whatever. You know, let me go back in time here and see. But yeah, when we went to that show, it was the early 90s. It wasn't even the internet. So the only way you could get exposure is by, like, I don't know, it's by, like, going and, you know, either passing out flyers at conventions or going on radio shows or, you know, doing stuff like that. So, you know, it was like back then it was more real. It was really word of mouth. Trying to find it here or whatever.
Well, sometimes those shows you could get on. There was a comic convention in like 76. It's the first one I ever went to. Remember that I told you about that TV clown Ho Ho in Oklahoma City?
Yeah.
You know, it was on Saturday morning.
Yeah,
I've seen that.
You've seen that picture?
Yeah. I didn't know the title.
Yeah, he's like a more nasty looking creature from the Black
Lagoon.
Not
as good. You can't beat the creature from Black Lagoon. Don't even bother.
He was pretty nasty though.
But on Ho Ho, somebody had a TV at work, and I came in and somebody said, "Oh, how you doing? Check this out." And there was a guy on the show holding up a flyer for that, and I said, "They're talking about comic books." And that's how. And then that night, Cal Gregor talked about
Cal Gregor
on
Sleepwalker's
Matinee, I guess.
I hope so.
But he was on that show. They had a guy come on. They were holding a flyer. And then they showed a clip from the Buster Crab Flash Gordon serial, which I had seen since I was 5. And I was like, what? And then he was holding a little toy spaceship, a little metal spaceship from the Flash Gordon serial, you know, which was, I guess, a toy in the 30s. And they said, you'll be selling things like that? Yeah, we'll have all kinds of stuff. I go, what? And, you know, like I said, those two TV commercials on that one Saturday. And then I went to the show. It was a real popular show.
Oh, did you go on the Ho Ho show?
No, I never went on that.
Oh, I thought you went on the Ho Ho show. Okay.
I went on the Foreman Scotty show, which was
what
the.
What was that?
was a cow.
Now you gotta find pictures.
No, it's
Foreman Scotty.
Foreman Scotty, he was a cowboy, and he had a ranch, and it was Channel 4, which is the NBC affiliate. And they used to show the Flintstones and the Bugs Bunny cartoon. They had their own skits. You know, he had his own crew, but he always had a galley, you know, the kids.
Yeah.
And he'd always go to each kid and talked to them. They always had the name tags with the logo on it, the sticker. And when I was 9 years old, my Cub Scout pack or troop, we went to it. We were on the show. And that was the last episode they did. I remember we're doing the show, and then when it finished, some of the guys were talking, and he said, some of the criminal cases, get ready, we're all going to make a lot of noise. What are they doing? I'm just sitting in the thing. He had a horse named Woody, which is just a stuffed horse, you know, but everybody knew it. And
one pantomime horse.
And one kid would sit on it, you know, during the show instead of the bullpen.
Oh, okay.
And all of a sudden, at one point, the foreman, Scotty's out doing the show, and then all of a sudden, the whole crew just starts yelling things out and coming out and moving things and, you know, taking things away. And then they make us get up out of the stands, and they start moving, shoving those away. And
wow.
When they're taking Woody, Foreman Scotty's like, what, Woody? Even Woody? What? Make sure he's fed and watered. And next thing you know, and I can see the monitor, we're all standing around Foreman Scotty, and he's standing there, and there's a spotlight. It's all black, just a spotlight around
us.
Yeah,
one of those deals, right? Like.
And he's like, well, I guess this is it. And he's talking about vacation and this and that. And they showed, you know, slides of, like, RVs and, you know, water skiing and stuff. And I could see us just standing there, and I said, this is bizarre. And that was it. That was then it was summertime. And I thought he was going to come back in the fall, but he never did.
Oh, my God. We have to look him up.
He was still with NBC, you know, NBC affiliate. He did voiceovers and commercials and stuff.
Local guy.
Yeah, but he never did the Foreman Scotty show anymore.
See, now in South Florida, we had Skipper Chuck.
Yeah, you told me that.
Chuck Zink, yeah. He was Popeye Playhouse. Apparently, they had a Popeye Playhouse here with a different, with a hostess. But, yeah, he was pretty famous, man, from the 50s through early 80s, I think he was doing that. You know, Chuck Zink, yeah. Foreman Scotty. And think in New York, they used to have a guy called Officer Bolton or something like that that did, like, they played the Three Stooges.
Yeah.
On the afternoons and stuff like that. Everybody had one back then, you know?
Performance, Scotty used to, it always changed over the years. We used to show Laurel and Hardy, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it was always sections of it. You know, you'd see sections every time. Then you'd show a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Then you'd show, for a while, they showed Flintstones.
Did you ever have a guy that read the Sunday Funnies down there?
No, I never heard of them.
Yeah, down in Miami, Charlie Baxter, M.T. Graves, the horror host. Like, on Sundays, he would be just Charlie Baxter, and you have Toby the Robot with him, and they read you the Sunday Funny. Awesome, man. It's awesome. Yeah, and even in New York, you know, there was a comedian named Chuck McCann, and he used to read the funnies, too, but what he did was he would dress up as, like, Orphan Annie, and it was kind of bizarre, and some of the characters, and then read them. Yeah, they used to do that. I personally can attest to the fact that they would have guys reading the Sunday cartoons on Sunday morning. It's all, well, they should do it again now.
You know, when you're talking about Little Orphan Annie, when I was a kid, my dad always read the Sunday Funnies, and I'd always look at it, and I'd ask, why doesn't Little Orphan Annie have eyes? And he'd say, it's just how the artist draws her. And then the Carol Burnett Show, Raquel Welch was on it. She was the, you know, guest, and they always had a musical at the end, and it was comic strips, newspaper comic strips. I think Raquel Welch is the one that sang the Alley-Oop song, you know, the Alley-Oop.
Oh, yeah, that old one, yeah, the doo-wop song.
And, the doo-wop, but the guys were dressed like cavemen, and they were dancing to it, and then Lyle Wagner, and I don't know who the other guy was, came out dressed as Superman and Captain Marvel.
Nice.
I kept seeing Captain Marvel, but they weren't publishing. I was asking, who is that guy with the yellow lightning bolt? It's Captain Marvel. What is he? Because I see references. And he goes, he's like Superman. Why don't they make him anymore? And then Raquel Welch came out and did a Little Orphan Annie song, dressed Little Orphan Annie, and she had a beach ball. But she had those white eyes. And I said, how did they do that? And I kept asking Dad again, why doesn't she have eyeballs? It's how the artist draws her. And then when the show ended, she was still dressed as Little Orphan Annie. And, you know, Carol Burnett would always come out with an autograph book for the guest. And I remember Raquel Welch took it, and then she pulled one of the eyes back. They were on the string. She pulled the look, and then she signed it. Oh, wow, that's something. I worked at a silkscreen place in high school.
Hey, at least your dad didn't tell you they're blind. Oh, no!
Yeah, also Danny Warbucks and that genie Punjab.
Punjab, yeah.
Not, those three characters didn't have eyeballs. Everybody else did.
Oh, I thought nobody... I didn't know that.
It was just those three. Okay. I don't remember anybody else missing eyeballs. So I guess if you're magic, you're an orphan, or you're rich, you don't have eyeballs.
If you say so.
Well, the X-Men. When the X-Men use their powers, their eyeballs
Does Cyclops have eyeballs?
I imagine.
You never see his eyes, though. Cause
I imagine when he uses his powers, he doesn't have eyeballs. He just can't see it.
That's gotta suck.
No, I worked at a silkscreen place in high school, and there was a rock station in Oklahoma City called 96X. And they had a mascot. It was a blue walrus. And at one point, we were printing stickers for him, and my boss missed the plate to put the eyeballs in the walrus. And so what we had to do was make another plate and reprint all those stickers to put eyeballs in the walrus.
Mm.
And I remember people would come in, other clients and stuff, and see that. And, you know, my the head guy was really pissed off about it. And, you know, it was costing money and effort and, you know, materials for just a little oversight, which happens. But I just remember my boss, he was always pretty funny, and he goes, "Listen, it was a little orphan Annie Walrus." And everybody laughed, like, you know. I said, "Well, you could have saved a lot of money if you could have convinced 96X of that."
See, when they did the Annie movie, they had eyeballs.
Yeah.
You know, I guess they didn't want everybody running around with, like, you know, contact lenses or something. Or it would be too bizarre for, like, you know, people to, like, you know, "Oh, my God, everybody's blind. Oh, that's too painful." Yeah, Harold Gray probably was a strange man.
Huh?
I don't even think they have that anymore, do they? They don't still make Little Elf and Annie, do they, cartoons? There's no new... they don't continue it anymore, do they?
I want to say I thought they did, but I haven't seen it in any paper I've read, but...
Yeah, I don't see it in the local paper.
I thought it was still around.
Is it still around? Okay, Dick Tracy's not around anymore, is it?
I
know the Phantom is, and some of those other ones like that are, and Flash Gordon I still think still gets...
See, but the Phantom I never saw in a paper till I moved here to St. Petersburg.
Terry Beatty, I think, draws the Phantom.
Yeah. But I think Dick Tracy was still, I'm guessing, was still around in some way.
I know Prince Valiant is, because I've seen that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny, because the paper became... Used to get the adventure strips, and now it's all, you know, gags or whatever.
That's because of size. They started taking more and more space from them. You can't really tell a story in that little bit of space.
That's true. Even though they tried it back in the old days, man.
And then they have that little top strip that can be removed if they want.
Oh, yeah.
And, which, you know, Bill Watterson was complaining about it. But, you know, I understand it's a restraint, but he did beautiful things with that little top strip. It was always kind of like he felt it was wasted space, but sometimes it gave it a different timing and feel for the comic. And but the reason they have a top space is the newspapers can reformat it to any way, and some of them like to put it in like a comic book page type size.
Mm-hmm.
And they can reformat it, and sometimes that top strip they can just cut off. Even if they run it in regular horizontal fashion, they can just remove the top strip, and they can run more strips per page.
What do you mean by the top strip?
The top two panels of a comic strip. You know, like Peanuts, it always has, like, a big drawing that says Peanuts featuring good old Charlie Brown.
It always has
Snoopy on the side of Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
Well, that can be removed. Some papers don't even run it.
Yeah,
Bill Watterson used to do things like... one of my favorite strips, it said, the first panel was black, and it said, in the beginning there was nothing. And then the second panel was this little square, and it was white, but it had an eyeball, like a Greek-style eyeball. It says, and then there was Calvin. And then the rest of the strip was all drawn like a Greek tragedy about, you know, the new gods came out, but Calvin was one of the old vengeful gods, and you know, he was causing havoc and everything. At the very last panel, he's got something built in Tinker Toys, and he's destroying them, and his mother's saying, "If you keep destroying your toys, I'm not going to buy you any new ones." And that was a strip. But that top, which says in the beginning there was nothing, and then there was Calvin, which to me was awesome. It had a timing and a feel for it. That could have been removed. and it had the logo for the strip in it. Well, they can remove that and just put on top of it a little text, you know, Calvin Hobbes by Bill Watterson. So that's what I mean, the top strip. Everybody has to have a throwaway section in the strip.
You remember when, like, the Sunday section was, like, 7 or 8 pages of comic strips in color? They used to have it like that. It was, like, it was amazing, you know? It was like, oh, my God, it's like a whole comic book every Sunday or whatever.
Yeah, we used to get, when I was a kid, we got 2 papers. We used to get the Daily Oklahoman and the Oklahoma...
The afternoon one?
The Oklahoma Journal. Well, the Daily Oklahoma had 2. That was the morning paper, and Oklahoma Times was the afternoon. But there was the Journal, which was another paper altogether. We had 2 papers. And on the Sunday, most people got both papers. So if you were at a friend's house or, you know, somewhere, you could get the comic sections for both.
Yeah, because obviously they had different strips in them. One would have Print Valley, the other one had whatever. And
but every one of them always had Peanuts.
Both of them had Peanuts.
They always had, both of them had Dennis the Menace.
How about the Great Family Circus?
Yeah, Family Circus was the other one that was in all of them.
Bill Keen.
But each one had different ones. And I just remember, I'm guessing I was in 5th grade, I started reading those all the time. And then when I was in 6th grade, I remember I had she was an English teacher. Gosh, she was wonderful. And somebody was talking about it, and I remember her name's just on the tip of my tongue. But she just said,
Miss Grundy?
No. But she said, I can't live if I don't get my Sunday funnies. Which is the type of woman she was, but that's what some kids were talking about was, they liked to read the Sunday comics. Everybody did. That was the thing.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And a lot of popular references is from the comics. The one that gets me was, I've seen reprints of them, but the old strips like Prince Valiant, Little Nemo, Flash Gordon was one solid page. Popeye?
Sure.
My God. What a wonderful thing. Those Little Nemo strips are just artistic and beautiful, and they always talk about the engravers, you know, the engraving in the newspaper, all the tones and colors and stuff they got. Incredible.
Was Prince Valiant like a page?
I think so.
Yeah, I know. They were important back then.
Well, like I said, and what I didn't quite understand, I'd always
Little Nemo was pre-comic books, wasn't it?
Huh?
Little Nemo was pre-comic books, wasn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
But, some of those strips, they had a basement strip, which I didn't quite understand. Like, Popeye had Sappho, you know, that he was a little short guy, and his wife was this really huge woman that kind of bullied him a little
bit. Oh, I remember, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And then he had, Dallas gave me that Fantagraphics Popeye reprints, and I've been reading those, and, the Sappho strips actually has a charm to it. I didn't quite understand because I get the Charlton Comics
reprints.
Popeyes. No, the comic books.
Oh,
Paul
the ones that the Bud Sagendorf ones, yeah.
No.
No?
No, in the 70s, the Charlton
books. Oh, in the 70s.
But Paul Fung was doing them. And they'd have, Watson Snossel? Sappho rented out a room. And that one guy that was in the Popeye strip that hated everybody, he showed up in it. I'm guessing that's where he started, but he was a crazy roommate that was an artist. And then another point, that's when he brought that crazy inventor in. I think it was O.G. Watts' nozzle. But in the Charlie comics, they'd have a story of Sappho and this guy. Who are these guys? Well, they came from the old comic strip.
Mm-hmm.
Flash Gordon, Alex Raymond, he had a strip called Jungle Jim.
Yeah, Jungle Jim.
And
they made movies of it.
I thought it was a separate strip he did before Flash Gordon. It was a basement strip. So Flash Gordon was never a full page. It was most of the page, but then he had a bottom section of Jungle Jim.
Oh, okay. And, just so you could have the whole page.
Well, like I said, Little Nemo filled the whole page, which to me was... I would rather just read the whole thing. I don't know really why they did the basement strips, but they broke it up. And then Bud Sagendorf also, instead of the second strip, he used to do an activity thing, you know, like puzzles and all that at the bottom of the seeker strips. But yeah, it's I know the Little Nemo. They put them out. I've got the hardbacks of them, but it was in the mid 2000s. They put out full size the comic.
I have one of them. The Little Nemo ones or whatever, the full size ones. I have like a reprint book of those somewhere.
The hardback?
That's a paperback of Little Nemo, but it's like a. It's like a big old deal or whatever.
I've got those. They were all printed larger, but is printed the size of an unfolded newspaper.
No.
That's what I'm talking about. Fantagraphics did. I bought the four Little Nemo and Slumberland books. Then they put out another one called Land of Wonderful Dreams. I think they did two of them, maybe. They meant to do more, but then they stopped. But somebody on LiveJournal posted that they were going to do the Little Nemo. They did. They were hardback. They were the size of the newspaper when it was unfolded. So you got to see the Little Nemo strip as it was.
Yeah.
And the guy was on, I think, Mr. Media. And he was talking about it. And he asked why he's doing it. He said, well, basically his collection that he's got is starting to crumble. Because, you know, it's newsprint. And he says it's starting to come, you know, turn to dust. And he says this is the only way we can preserve it. But those hardbacks back in like 2005, 2006, they were like $100 each.
No, those I don't have.
And I don't know how many they printed. I've never seen one except online. It'd be nice, but...
Sure.
Where would you put it? You know?
On your wall.
A hardback book. Yeah. Anyway, well, listen, we've been yakking about all kinds of stuff. Let's have a music break.
Break.
Good. You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
And we're back, and that was the band that's active with the song Waters Part from their second record. I think it's their second record, called Cypress, from 1982. Good time for college radio.
I thought so, but once again, you're bringing up something I've never heard of.
Okay, Mitch Easter was the guy who produced the first few REM records, so that's where that's where he achieved notoriety. But he had his own band, and they were great, and he's a great musician and singer and songwriter as well. And I guess he still does occasional records. He has a studio in, I think it's Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where he does most of his production work and stuff like that. And, you know, good stuff. So there you go, Waters Part from Cypress. Go out and get it on Amazon or your local record store, or, you know, wherever they sell music. Or iTunes.
iTunes, streaming.
Streaming, yeah. YouTube, wherever you want to go.
So there you go. Very astute.
All right, so now we're back.
Anyway, I feel kind of bad that we started the show off talking about things like game shows and Kitty Carlisle.
Yeah, because we just had a whole show off the air.
Yeah, we turned off the mic, and also we started talking about comic books, and I was like, we should have recorded this.
But no, we can't because, you know.
One thing we were talking about was, I never bought it. You had the Steve Rude book. What was that called?
Oh, where is it? I don't know. You put it back there. It's like a Steve Rude guide of all the Nexus, style guide for all the Nexus characters.
Yeah, Draw Nexus, How-To Tips and Techniques, limited edition.
Yeah, and I saw that on Amazon ages ago, and I said, oh, that looks nice, so I went out and got it. And Don is like, this is great, man.
Yeah, well... I remember when this came out, because this is when he was doing that Rude Dude Productions. You know, he's doing the Nexus comic himself. This is in 2006. And, I never bought it, but it's spiral bound. And it says, spiral bound for easy drawing board access. But, you know, it's neat. It's
sure
got all the storyboards, like all the Hanna-Barbera stuff does. He's showing how to break down the characters. He's got notes, which I guess is interesting, because how many times have you seen, like, Wendy Pinney when she was doing ElfQuest? She had other artists draw it. And Howard Chaykin, you know, stopped doing American Flag and had other artists. I mean, those are, you know, all the Marvel comics and stuff when you take over a book. This is a great reference because it's got most of the characters, model sheets, ideal style guides, his ship. It's really something. I remember when I saw it, I wasn't really interested. And
it's got some sketches he does in the back.
Yeah, it's got all kinds of stuff.
You were talking about his influences. We mentioned Toth, Kirby. We forgot Andrew Loomis. That's
Andrew Loomis.
Big one, yeah. It's funny how he synthesized all these people's work into his art, and it's seamless.
Yeah, and that's one thing we're talking about. There was never... We were talking about somebody else, but... Steve Rude was one of them. He absolutely had a distinct style that was all his. And when I hear about... I remember I picked up a Mangus Robot Fighter. I liked that when I was a kid. And I didn't know who it was. I said, man, I could see where... It was never a ripoff, but I could see where Steve Rude started drawing faces. And I realized it was Russ Manning later. And Alex Toth, even though I would never... think Alex Toth and Steve Rude were ever the same. He's got that Jack Kirby feel. You can see he loves Jack Kirby, but he channels it in his own way. But yeah, Andrew Loomis, you see a lot of Andrew Loomis in his work. But nevertheless, he's made it his own. And I've always seen a lot of Dr. Seuss in Steve Rude. I mean, not drawing the characters. Some of the aliens he drew that way, but he always had these plants and weird contraptions.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I that was one of the reasons I always liked the Nexus comic. You know, it was just, it had fun. Even though it was about a guy executing mass murderers.
Well, yeah. I remember, I think the Nexus magazine came out around the same time as Love and Rockets, didn't it?
It came out before, because, I don't know why. In '82, I went to a convention in Dallas, and they had they had Justice Machine.
I remember Justice
Machine. Yeah, which came out of Texas, I'm told.
Mike Gustavich or somebody.
I never bought it. I just remember seeing it. It was a big black and white magazine, and it was, you couldn't miss it. A lot of dealers had it. I'd see it advertised in comic trades. And then later I started seeing Nexus, and that's one that had the flexible record in it.
That's right.
And I never, there was three of them. I never bought those either. And then
Capital Comics.
Yeah, Capital Comics. And then I found out Steve Rude was on some podcast recently, and he was just talking about it. He said that the reason Nexus came about was Justice Machine came out, and I guess the Capital Comics was some type of distributor out in Wisconsin.
Yeah, Capital Distribution. Yeah, it was a biggie. They were Lim and Diamond were the two biggies.
I guess Mike Barron knew them somehow. It was a circle of people that knew each other, and they're trying to do a comic. And then when they realized Justice Machine was the thing, they thought, well, we could do this. So they did the Nexus. And then later, Capital came out as a color comic company. That's when I got out of boot camp and came home, and the store I went to saved all my books. And they threw the first issue of Color Nexus, which I didn't really want. But I didn't argue with the guy. He said, oh, yeah, I saved you one of these. And he threw it in a pile. And I was sitting there with my mouth half open, like getting ready to save. I said, I'll take it. And I looked at it, well, this isn't bad at all. I didn't really understand what all the flying heads were about, the gorillas, you know, but then Britt and Rick came up, and they were talking about it. I said, yeah, it's really good. And I remember Steve Rude did a fill-in issue for Teen Titans. Teen Titans, it was when Prez and Wolfman was doing it.
I never saw that.
It was called the Recombatants. And it was a group of kids that had superpowers, but they were artificial, and they weren't going to live very long. It was good. But Steve Rude did the cover and the insides. And I remember when Perez, you know, started doing Crisis, they got Garcia Lopez to draw the Teen Titans.
Those I remember.
And a friend of mine on the
Ed
ship.
Ed Barreto, too, right? Edward Barreto, maybe, too?
Well, I know he was inker for Perez sometimes.
Yeah. Okay, that's it.
But a guy on my ship, when I told him that, he was kind of upset. He goes, they should have got the guy that drew the Recombatants, or however you say that. And I said, yeah, but I think he's doing Nexus. Who should do this? But I still didn't buy the Capital Comics. And then later, when Dark Horse started printing Nexus, and I saw some of the pages and, you know, samples. Oh, wait a minute. After that, I read Nexus religiously. And then I went and got the old issues. It was one of the greatest comics I ever read. It's, for some reason, which always mystified me, never gained footing. You know,
it lasted for a while, but it never became a big hit.
And you know, it did 50. I remember the 50th issue. It was just, to me, that was some of the greatest comics I ever read. Because a lot of times they have the big double size, you know, spectacular 50th issue. It never lives up to the hype. This one did. It was, they started that whole arc about Gravity Well imploding and General Loomis, who created it, and Nexus killed him. And then the Loomis sisters were, you know, plotting to go after. I thought, well, this, they just kept building. And then it got up to the 50th issue, and then, you know, everybody's fleeing the web, and Nexus, you know, goes to the bowl-shaped world and saves Gravity Well. Well, this is awesome! And then after that, Steve Rude left the series. But he did that four-issue, The Next Nexus, which is about the Loomis sisters again. Some of the greatest comics I ever read in my life. You know, it was something else how he did it. And, I don't know. They've done other Nexus series, and they're good, but it just never seemed to find footing. You know, at one point, the last miniseries at the time Dark Horse put out, they put it out in black and white. And then later, Steve Rude brought up his own company and did three issues. It was supposed to be four, but ended up being three. And he's doing a newspaper now.
The Nexus newspaper?
Yeah, well, again, like this, I saw this on the site. I never bothered with it, the How to Draw Nexus. But he had a newspaper, and I never bothered with it because you have to subscribe to it. And then again on that podcast, I've got to find that podcast now, and since I reference it so much. But he was talking about the newspaper, I guess it's going to be a year's worth of newspapers. But Mike Barron's writing, Steve Rude's drawing it, and it's a full-color newspaper. And he was saying he's given other options. You can buy it on, you can subscribe to it and get it, I guess, once a month, like you would a, you know, paper. Or you can get, like, six issues. And there was even an option, you could just get all the issues in one fell swoop, you know, when it's finished. And he said, we'll sell them till we're out. But then he was talking about, they have different tiers. You can get a package and get, I don't know, you get other stuff with it.
Okay.
But when I listened to it, I went to the site, and you can get just the newspapers. I think it's $15.
What do you mean by that? Is it a newspaper, entire Nexus comic book or something like that?
I'm thinking it's a paper of like 4 to 6 pages maybe.
Okay.
I've never seen one.
I'll have to look it up.
I've seen pictures online of people holding it up. I mean, it's a full paper, and it's not a newsprint. And then Dark Horse Presents did a 3 issue Nexus story that's serialized. I never bought them, but I found out they have it in a trade. I've got to order the trade.
Again, if
I didn't listen to the podcast, I knew about the newspaper, but didn't really know what it was and didn't bother with it.
Well, I guess if you go to his website, you'll see all the rude dude you said .com or something.
Yeah, I'll have it on the blog, but I've been to it and I get his emails, but I don't know. It's just something about him. I just kind of and then go on, you know. You don't need to sell Steve Rude to me because I buy his stuff when I see it. I haven't seen these in any store. And when I get them, it's just like an infomercial that isn't telling me what I'm interested in, which is strange because I love him. But anyway.
Yeah. There you go. What is it called again? The Draw Nexus.
Draw Nexus.
How to Tips and Techniques. Limited edition, everybody. Go out and get it. It's funny because it is like a spiral bound book or whatever. You know, it probably last longer than a paperback, so.
Well, it's made to last though. It's on good stock.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
not flimsy.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
And it is, what are you saying? It is set up. You can just roll the thing over and leave on your drawing table and not have it close, not have it fall off. It's good. Anyway, Al's biting at the bit because it's time for
Pullapalooza!
Pullapalooza time.
There you go. And that was our new song by Dallas.
Oh, right. Dallas. Awesome. Pullapalooza time. Yes, we know you love it. You can't live without it. We're going to like blindly grab comic books and figure out if we know anything about them. So here
Which
we go.
We don't.
You want to start?
I'll start because you got a bunch.
Okay. Grab a book, any book.
All right. I'm going to grab right here in the center. If I can get it out.
Okay. Oh, you grabbed two, so now you have to talk about
All right. Book. Once again, it's a horror book. 100-page spectacular for 60 cents. Have you the nerve to face the unexpected?
Oh, it's one of those old DC 100-page trades or whatever. I mean, 100-page comic books.
159.
Well, let's see who's in it. I bet you it's got a Nick Carty cover.
Yeah, I'm thinking. Yeah, it's got an N and a circle. Yeah, this is, these books, I don't know, I always liked it when they had, DC always did this, where they'd have 3 panels on the front. It says, New, A Cry in the Night. Chill 2, Frozen in Fear. Thrill 2, Creature That Never Existed. And a gorilla with 4 arms. A giant gorilla with 4 arms. Plus, 10 more masterworks of suspense and shock.
So some of them would have one new story in them.
Yeah.
I don't know about it, but that one does.
So you're getting 13 stories.
13 exciting stories.
Oh, wow.
Is that Toth? No.
No, it's art by, again, Jess.
Just Jodelman or something?
Yeah, Jodelman. I've never heard of him.
A Filipino, I believe.
Anyway. Yeah, well, you can tell. It looks like a Filipino artist.
Yeah, at that point, the Filipinos had taken over the DC horror books. I mean, every one of them had a Alcala, Redondo, or, you know.
It's good artwork.
That's probably the new story in the book. I bet you got that because it's probably got some Toth reprints or something towards the middle of the book. Is that Jerry Grandinetti?
Yeah, Story and Shocker. Story and Art, Jerry Grandinetti.
That's another new one then. Okay.
Was it?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. There was a... Go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm looking at it now and I'm thinking, oh, this isn't bad, but I know if I would have bought this at the time...
You would have might have gone, let me go to the next one.
It's too wonky.
Too sloppy, yeah. I need something more. I need a tighter story. Grant and Eddie did a few stories with Wally Wood inking, and they were amazing. Lee Elias, maybe?
Yeah, Lee Elias, yeah.
I can see because of that little circle. Yeah, that's how he signed his name, yeah. That's the gorilla with the eight arms.
The creature that never existed.
The gorilla with the forearms, I should say, not eight arms. That's a reprint.
It's got eight arms. Yeah.
Eight arms? Okay.
On the cover, yeah, covers four of them as well. Yeah, I'm sorry, it is four arms. I'm sorry.
That's the reprint from, like, whatever, 1950s book or whatever.
Yeah, this is good, though.
Lee Elias was an interesting artist. He was kind of like, he was around even in the... 80s. I think he's the guy who did the Rook for Warren or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
He did a lot of work, but he never became like a big, you know, popular
guy. I've seen a lot of stuff in reprints. I mean, as soon as I see it, I recognize it.
Yeah. Solid work, yeah.
Yeah, it was good. All right, now is another one that doesn't have any credits for the artist, as they used to do, The Telltale Hand.
Let me take a look at it. Maybe I can identify him. This looks to me like it's... wow. Somebody who I don't know. Wow, I don't know who it is. Maybe early Kurt Swan, because that looks like a Superman. I don't know. Maybe it's early Kurt Swan. I don't know.
It could be. It looks
good.
Can't
identify it.
Telltale Hand. Yeah, you can tell this is an old one, though.
Yeah, they had to add the thing on the top because, you know, those books were printed bigger. So, yeah, they had to shrink them down for the 1970s. It looks like a little bit like Kurt Swan. I don't know.
You can tell, like, he's walking through a city, and they got a he's walking in front of a theater, and there's a doorman out there in front. It's plenty of good seats, no waiting. There's a woman in the booth to take tickets. Oh, it wasn't, it's a theater, but it's for, that show. It says, how could he hide his evil past? The mark of the strangler. This is a poster. Nice. I would like to see
Kung
his
Fu. It's a kung fu ad.
Yeah, the master
one of the
complete
many.
Course of kung fu. Wow. All right, I was blackmailed by a phantom. Again, no signature.
I see. This
but
looks
it's a ghost.
Like. This looks like. Oh man. Looks like, I don't know. it looks like it could be a lot of different people.
Yeah, I was going to say,
I don't know.
It looks like a lot of DC artists, but I like it.
Yeah, it's solid.
But I couldn't, there's nothing distinguishing. Oh, this came out in 74. I can tell because of Superman.
The Wiz Comics. And
yeah,
the,
Wiz
that
Comics.
Sort of people used to like call up at the comic shop and go, I have Superman number one.
Yeah, you told me that.
Or Batman number one. I go, really? Yeah. I go, is it a really big book? Oh, yeah, it's humongous. I go, it's a reprint. No, it's not. And then, you know, the argument would go on and on.
Yeah,
and
but
on.
I'll tell you, I love those. That was...
The Treasuries.
Yeah, those things were huge. And getting the first Superman and the first Detective 27, you know. And they were just a thrill a minute. The first Wiz Comics.
Oh, yeah.
All right, now this is Frozen in Fear, art by Fred Carrillo. A story by George Kasdan.
George Kasdan, yeah, he did tons of... George Kasdan did work for Filmation, too. He wrote some of those Superboy cartoons and stuff
I love
like
those.
Yeah.
I always love Superboy. I never heard of either one of these.
Fred Carrillo, yeah, he did a lot of... I think he's Filipino. He did a lot of work in that
'70s
era, even up to the 80s.
This
yeah.
looks old, though.
No, it's definitely of its time.
Yeah. He's good. He's good.
Solid artist, man. All of them were.
He's good at drawing.
Some styles, they were all solid artists. Some styles are more interesting than others, you know, maybe. I don't know. But
he starts out, he's drawing these phantoms, and they're nice-looking people, even though they're phantoms. But, you know, they're from, like, I don't know, the Victorian age or something. And then all of a sudden, they turn into these They're still phantoms, but they're skeletal, coming apart. They're gruesome. And then at the end, they're nice looking phantoms again, talking to the main guy. That's good. All right, now here's the Swami of Broadway, art by Bill Ely.
Bill Ely, another guy that from the 50s.
And he's good.
A lot of guys, some of those guys never really, that you know, when like the comic books imploded in the 50s, a lot of comic book artists never came back. They just, He may have, but as far as I know, he was a 50s guy. Maybe, man, he might have come into the 60s, I shouldn't say that.
He's unique, but he's got a little bit of a, he's his own person, but I see some Gil Kane upshots in this, and I see some Carmine Infantino kind of.
There you go.
Shots, but he's got his own way. It's nice. And the Rainbow Man. And I don't see any credits whatsoever. But there's a silhouette of a blue figure with a gun robbing the people. It says, that man come out of the wall. He's blue from head to toe. It's the Rainbow Man.
Hey, we're doing the Sunday funnies, man. We're reading comic books for you on the radio.
Well,
on the podcast or whatever. All those are nice, strong stories. I mean, not exciting. You know what I mean? They're well done, but they're not, like, super exciting. You know what I mean? Is that Kirby or something, or no?
I don't see any credit. It just says, the night I watched myself die.
I think that's Bob Brown.
Is it?
Yeah, it's Bob Brown, sure.
I like Bob Brown.
Yeah, this looks from different. Challengers. Yeah, it's Bob Brown.
It is. I can see on this.
I put that... I'm Destination Nightmare. My blog. I, that story's on there.
Really?
Yeah, I got a scan. I had a scan of it, and I popped it in there just because, like, oh yeah, Bob Brown. I gotta have a Bob Brown
story.
Some of
these, like this panel here, it looks like Ramona Freyden.
Does look like Ramona Freyden. Yeah.
Not the finishes, but just that, and then some of it on here. It still looks like Ramona Freyden. Like if she broke the story down and somebody else finished it.
But you can tell those faces are from. They look like the guys from the Challengers.
this is nice.
Yeah, that one's on Destination Nightmare.
Okay, this guy here, the protagonist, has got a gun.
He looks like the puppet master from...
he's a bald character. He's bug eyes. He's got a jacket, a long coat with the collar turned up. And his teeth look kind of jagged in a way. There was a Richie Rich comic strip. A comic book that I loved, and I think Howie Post was the artist of it, I'm guessing. But at the end of the, it was kind of an adventurous one, but the bad guy was this guy, except the jacket was black.
He looked just like him?
Yeah, I think they used this as the model.
Huh.
But his teeth were actually jagged like in a cartoon, and he was bald, kind of Lex Luthor. His eyes were... This guy, his bug eyes are kind of unsure. The one Richie Rich, the guy's eyes were really like Orson Welles, sure.
Okay.
But instead of a long brown coat with an upturned collar, it was a black leather, short black leather jacket with an upturned collar. But I see that, and the first thing I think is that Richie Rich bad guy.
Now you have to find the book.
The Demon Gun. No credits on this one either.
I'm not on the top either.
I don't see.
Let me take a look. Let's see if I can.
I'll tell you, that's a lot of good stories in that book.
Oh boy, yeah, that's another guy. Oh, it looks like Infantino, man. Double check it. See if it looks like Infantino to you in some panels. some of the shots, the faces look like Infantino.
Some of it.
By Giacoya or somebody like that.
Yeah, because the inking looks nothing like
no, Infantino. Not that sketchy.
Well, see, some of them do the bigger faces, but then the smaller ones don't look anything.
Maybe
like
it's Frank Giacoya. He did a lot of work for the books in the 60s.
The Strange Experiment of Dr. Grimm. Again, no credits. This one, it's not really interesting me too much.
No? Okay. Let's see.
And then, Who's Lying in My Coffin? By Alex Nino, which I
That's
could
a
tell.
New story, obviously.
Yeah, as soon as I saw it. Story by Carl Wessler. Wow.
That's a new one. So they stuck in like three or four new stories and then a bunch of reprints just to get your 50 cents or whatever it was.
I would have gave it gladly. This is a lot of comic book to
That's
read.
It's a lot of content.
Yeah, for 60 cents, it is a bargain. A bargain.
Right. A bargain at twice the price.
All right, now you get to grab one from my pile.
I just saw it. That's, hopefully bugs didn't get in it, but
I think it's a thief.
It's probably the way it is. Alright, here we go. And I picked up
Ragnarok.
Ragnarok. Is that Walt Simonson?
Yeah, that's Walt Simonson's book.
And nice, man. I've never seen it. You probably got this at
Hey, Wilson's. No, I've subscribed to it. Ragnarok is
Oh, he's got the pencils too at the back.
It's nice. Walt Simonson's doing Thor again, but it's not the Thor from Marvel Comics. And this Thor's dead. And we talked about it in a past episode. It's a husband and wife. They were blue-type elves. They were assassins. And the wife was hired to do a job. The husband was there with the daughter. And then the wife is killed. But they bring Thor back. They find Thor dead on the throne. But his jaw is gone. And his face looks like a mummified skeleton.
Looks like a zombie Thor.
Yeah. With white hair. I like how Walt Simonson drew the hammer because it's kind of elegant. It's not like the massive, which I love that too, the Marvel Comics, the big stone mallet slab. But this one, it looks kind of like a Lord of the Rings type thing. But this is the 10th issue, and I'll tell you, it's nothing like what I was expecting. That woman dies, and then her husband comes after him. And he's got the daughter with him. And the husband's trying to kill him. And then they become allies. And he always refers to Thor as my lord, even though he wants to kill him. And all of Asgard's gone. All the gods are gone. It's just Thor. But they run into all the different things around. The giants, the dwarves, the... But it's lawless. You know, just like an aftermath of everything. And at one point, these demons are coming after him. And they don't know what to do with the daughter, and Thor kills the daughter. And the guy's his ally, and I'm like, what? And he says, don't worry, just fight. And then when it's all over, Thor brings her back to life. And I'm thinking, I never thought of that. And the guy was kind of mad and horrified and calming down. And then he starts talking about bringing his wife back. And he says, well, I can't do that. He's talking about the reason he killed the daughter was to protect her when these people came in because they could fight. And he says he didn't kill the dog, you know, the wife. But I don't know. It's just, it's a lot of stuff in here that I really enjoy. I think they did 6 issues and stopped for a while, and they came back after the 7th issue. And Walt Simonson was on again another podcast I don't remember, and he was talking about it. He enjoys doing them, but he says he's not as fast as he used to be. But it's not exactly the way you think. He made a joke about it years ago that he uses a lot of lines, which he always did. But he says, you know, a lot of people always make the observation, and a lot of times complain about artists that get simpler as they go on. You know, Alex Toth was one, and Jaime Hernandez was another one. Mobius was one. And he said, everybody says that that's kind of what it goes. He says, I went the opposite route. He gets more and more lines. And that's what he's saying. He's not as fast, but it's because he's just adding so much. But I'll tell you, as you said, it's nice. The colors are nice. The characters are nice, even though I wouldn't want to kiss this character. I really look forward to this whenever it comes out. It's a great, great book. I know the first issue's been put out in trade. I guess the next 6 issues, when it's finished, will be out in trade. It's worth reading. It's a lot different than his Marvel Comics Mighty Thor was.
Sure, yeah. It's one of the zombie.
Yeah, well, but I'm interested to find out exactly what happens, because Thor's whole guidance is gone. Like I said, Asgard's gone. And I can't remember exactly which god it was, but he did meet one god that was waiting. And again, the whole approach and how he does it, I'm like, God, that's neat. I wasn't thinking of that. It's not predictable.
There you go. So that's brand new or from a year or two ago?
No, it's the recent issue.
That's the recent one? Yeah. Oh, okay.
I just grabbed a pile of comics that I had just to, okay, now we're going through Owls. Oh!
All right,
Brave and the Bold, nice. 165, starring Batman and Man-Bat.
Good old Jim Aparo.
And Man-Bat has a baby. On the cover it says, Scree. My baby's dying, it's all your fault, Batman. Scree.
Jim Aparo probably did like hundreds of Brave and the Bold. I think he went on like a 6 or 7 year run.
Marty Pascal wrote it.
Oh, okay.
Don Newton and Dan Adkins, guest artists.
Oh, it's not? The cover's by Aparo. Don Newton did it. All right. Nice.
Is that Aparo?
Yeah, that's an Aparo cover.
I was thinking, the Batman looks like Aparo, but the Man Bat looks like Joe Kubert a little bit.
No. So Don Newton did. Oh, Don Newton was great, man. My God, he was a fine artist.
You know, we were talking about, again, Don Newton was never an artist I ever liked, but then, that's Don Perlin. I always put Don Newton. Don Newton and Don Perlin, I always put in the same.
No. But, Don Perlin is great, too, but Don Newton was kind of like, it was a little more of a, there's a little more going on.
Yeah. Well, he's playing with panels.
He did great work for DC when he was doing the Captain Marvel books and he brought them back or whatever. Yeah,
you always talk highly of those.
But he did a great Batman, and that's one of them.
Was he the one that did the Captain Marvel Jr. stories?
Yeah,
he did work that I liked. I mean, some of this looks like a Filipino artist.
That's funny.
How he draws the Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne is in a doctor's office. Wait a minute. He's got his Batman suit on. Alfred's there and the doctor's there.
Wow, what could happen? What happened?
This is the best I can do, Bruce. As long as you refuse to come back to my office for further treatment, you're lucky it wasn't worse. If whatever caused the wound had punctured deeper, it might have severed an artery. Just let me give you something to ease the pain. No, Douglas. Nothing. I can't risk it. Got to keep my head clear tonight. Yeah, but the way he's drawing Bruce Wayne without a shirt, all the rendering of the muscles, it looks like a Filipino artist.
There you go.
Was it Don Newton? He did. Oh,
Dan Adkins inked it.
Wow. Was Dan Adkins Filipino?
No.
Wow, a lot of shading, too. Yeah, some of Dan Adkins. He must have been.
I'm sure he got tight pencils. Yeah, they came out the first time as the new Teen Titans.
Oh, the Black Hole from Disney.
Oh, my God. Why? Okay, here's a question for you. Why? I know it's got to be something to do with the printing. Why did they put, like, red squares on the top?
The top. I don't remember the Marvel Comics having it.
The DC's had them.
On each page is a little tiny rectangle of magenta, and it's cut off. It's got to be something
about the dates, maybe, or something, maybe.
I think it was a printer's guide. I've seen stuff like this, but not so blatant. I always noticed it all the time.
Oh, man, yeah.
But I couldn't tell you. I've seen things like it up to a point, but that's when this started in the
80s, right?
Yeah, it was in the 80s.
That's before the Flexo.
I was going to say the Flexograph.
That's before Flexographic. That still actually looks nice. The colors are all, like, in sync or whatever.
Flexographic is something. Whenever somebody from DC talks about it, they always talk like it was the biggest mistake anybody ever made. They were plastic. Weren't they plastic plates?
Plastic plates.
And they just came out. And Marvel had some, too, later, like in the 90s.
Yeah, I think
they did. Or late 80s. It just looked so bad.
Yeah, those are fun books, man.
I always loved Brave and the Bold, but I loved it because of Jim Aparo. But this is a good issue. It's nice.
Let me see. What issue is it again here? 165, yeah. Yeah, this must have been like Aparo was on vacation or something, because he usually did every issue. Pencils, inks, and letters.
I wonder if that's because he, well, I said guest artist, but he was starting to do The Outsiders. The Outsiders?
This is 1980. Was he doing Batman the Outsiders?
No, that was in 83.
Yeah, this was pre-Outsiders. Who knows?
Yeah, he started The Outsiders at the end of 82 or beginning of 83, Batman the Outsiders. And I think they canceled Brave and the Bold, and Batman the Outsiders was the new book.
All right, well, let me grab a book from...
Take a book, any book.
Okay, this one.
All right.
Cage, number one, Luke Cage.
This just came out.
Wow, it's very cartoony.
The cartoonist that did Dexter's Lab on Cartoon Network.
Oh, really? This is the guy?
Yeah, Jenny Tatowski.
Oh, my God.
And he's done those Haunted House cartoons. I can't think of the name of it. They're the computer animated stuff.
Oh, my God.
And he also did a fantastic Popeye piece because Sony Pictures is trying to do a Popeye cartoon, and he wanted to do it. And it was greatness, done on a computer. But anyway, this, again, before the show came out and I'd met Al, they posted a drawing he did of Luke Cage from the 70s. And he was supposed to do it, and I was looking everywhere for it, and it never came out. And all of a sudden they said, well, they waited, for whatever reason, they never came out, and then he got busy. But he put this thing out, but it's the 1970s Luke Cage with the yellow shirt, yellow boots, chain belt,
classic.
And the tiara. And he said Sweet Christmas all the time. Stephen DeStefano and Scott Wells.
Stephen DeStefano did a book. Flazzo, it was something else. He's
what an amazing man.
It was Amazing Man. Yep, it was Amazing Man. Yeah.
Oh, Stephen DeStefano inked it.
He's an anchor, yeah.
Scott Willis. So, Jenny Tartakovsky. He wrote it and drew it. But
that's fun stuff.
It is fun stuff. What's funny was a lot of people were excited about this. And I've only seen the first issue. It just came out, but I haven't seen a second one. But it's got, disco roller skating, roller disco, I think it's called.
From the 70s.
Yeah, they have these three guys in these one-piece open chest jumpsuits with bell bottoms and stars, all dressed the same. And, they're the bank rollers. Just stuck it to the man. But it's a real 70s disco kind of thing, but there were some people on some Facebook group complaining about it. What is this? I love Cage. This is terrible art.
Well, it's different.
It's fun, but I wanted to read this from way back. And I don't know. I'll be honest with you, I like it, but it's not as good as I thought it was going to be. Oh, the X-Men show up.
I saw Cyclops Jean Grey there.
You know, I read this, and now that I'm looking through it, I'm thinking, I really don't remember it too much. I really kind of lambasted the book, and I don't mean to, because I do like it. It was fun. I've never seen the
second issue?
Yeah, Hunted. I've never seen it.
You know, Miles asked me a question last week, and I guess I gave him an answer, but I wasn't sure about it. At the time of the Burn X-Men, was Phoenix pretty much the most powerful of all the mutants?
Yeah.
She was. Okay, I said yes.
Yeah, what happened?
Because you could destroy worlds or whatever.
I think it was... I don't know if Len Wein was... I think Chris Claremont was writing the book by that time. But Dave Cockrum and Chris Claremont wanted the Thor character in the X-Men. Because in the Avengers, Thor's there, but he's the all-powerful character. He's the super muscle. And so whenever there's any kind of... And there was a lot of times they always made reference and jokes and complaints about... Sometimes in Avengers, Thor wasn't there. And at the last minute, when they really needed something, he would show up. And they were kind of wanting something like that for the X-Men. And so that's when basically Jean Grey went through that, death and transformation and turned into Phoenix. And that was the whole deal. Well, then Dave Cockrum left the book and John Byrne came on. And John Byrne always hated Phoenix. I say that, he sure drew her to death, but
sure.
He said what he didn't like about Phoenix is she turned the rest of the team into a fifth wheel, And he was right, and she just got... That was the thing they were always alluding to in the book, was that she was unpredictable, and she was... sometimes her power just seemed limitless, and all of a sudden she collapsed and faint. And it was always a fear, and she got to be so powerful that, that's when they took her to the courts and had to kill her.
Oh, that's what I thought. Yeah, I wasn't, I just...
Well, the original thing in that X-Men book was they were going to basically give her a lobotomy. And I want to say that she was Jean Grey, but she didn't have her mutant powers anymore. And then she would go off with Scott, and that would be it. She left the X-Men. And it was kind of sad, but she would live. But then... John Byrne took a trip with Jim Shooter, and he complained the whole time about Phoenix. And they already had the story drawn, and Jim Shooter said, well, if she killed a, The complaint was when Chris Claremont wrote it, when John Byrne drew it, she destroyed a planet. But Chris Claremont didn't have people on it. But when John Byrne drew it, he drew a race of people, always joke, asparagus people. They were awesome. But he drew some people in there and showed them die. So it was an occupied planet of all these inhabitants. And when Jim Shooter found out, he says, look, if she killed the planet, she's got to, you know, there's got to be retribution. And so that was it. And as we were talking about, Claremont and Byrne, there was no trust between them. You know, the Beatles did that, where the rule was minority rule, and if anybody wanted to add something to song, they could, or change something, or do something. If there's trust, it works out. Well, Claremont and Byrne did the same thing, but, you know, you drew asparagus people in this, and I had to kill one of my favorite characters, you know what I mean? You know what I mean?
I know exactly what
you're saying. That, no complaints. They were some of the greatest comics I ever read, and then John Byrne, there was a book SQ Productions put out called The Art of John Byrne.
I have it, yeah.
It's one of my favorite books. And there's a big interview, and he's talking about all the plans him and Clarice Claremont were going to do. You know, they were going to do like a what-if story. And it's basically like all the Avengers and X-Men got married and had offspring and stuff. And or something about a plan. It's so long ago I read it, but it was neat. And some of the stories he was talking about him and Chris were going to do, they were a great team, and none of that ever came about, you know. But anyway, greatness. All right, we're back to Al's pile of awesomeness. And
here we got an oldie.
Oh, my God, this is one of my favorite issues.
More apparently.
All right, this is Adventure Comics 433. And this is when they called it Weird Adventure Comics. And it's the Spectre.
Those are the Fleischer ones,
yeah.
Right?
This is the Spectre in, what was it, 1972 or 73.
Something like that.
I can read it right here. 74, okay.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was 73 or 74. But Michael Fleischer wrote them, and Jim Parle drew them, and they brought the Spirit, the Spectre back. But it wasn't the Golden Age Spectre or even the Silver Age Spectre that tried it. This guy was an act of vengeance.
And he was nasty.
They drew him out of DC continuity. Because the first story they did, it just fascinated me. I mean, a friend of mine was looking at it and goes, wait a minute, this is weird. Because there was a reporter assigned to, you know, Jim Corrigan.
Jim Corrigan, yeah.
Yeah, Jim Corrigan was actually the Spectre, but he was, he was a Spectre, but he was a police inspector.
He got killed, right, or whatever?
Yeah, he was killed and brought back as a spirit of vengeance, but he still was, you know, James Corrigan, I think his name was?
Jim Corrigan.
Oh, Jim Corrigan. But there was a reporter assigned to him on that first issue, and I can't remember what his name was, but, you know, he had dark hair and glasses, Clark Kent glasses, and he was kind of like a bit uncomfortable at times. But at the same time, he was a reporter, and he was sure, he was a convincing person. He was a convincing human being. He stood up for himself. He let his, you know, opinions be known. But when he was assigned, he goes up to introduce himself to Jim Corrigan. He goes, Inspector, my name is, I know, Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter. Just stay out of my way. And then one of the cops there says, Clark Kent, hey, are you really Superman? And my friend pointed it out. Says, wait a minute, this isn't, you know. But then, I don't know, several issues. It was a Brave and the Bold, and it was Batman and the Spectre that Jim Parle drew. And I thought, okay, well, I guess it is part of DC continuity.
At that point, yeah.
But it was just, you know, a few issues later. But these are absolutely, the stories always started off, it had nothing to do with any of the main characters. It was always something occurring, a robbery or somebody getting swindled. Or a setup, and then the story would slowly unfold, and then all of a sudden people would start dying. Inspector Corrigan would show up, and then after that, the Spectre came out and turned you into glass and shattered you, or turned you to wood.
Turned to wood and
run through a buzzsaw.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
I think they got into some kind of trouble, didn't they, with the Authority Comics Code Authority or something.
I You'd mentioned that. I was never aware of any of that. I'm not surprised, because as a kid reading these, wow, these are awesome.
Yeah.
And my friends were just eating it up. We never saw any like it, but it was, he turned the guy in the ice and slid him off the ledge. Look out, he's falling.
and he shatters. Bucks.
Gasp, oh my God. Thus shatter the vile ambitions of all evil men. That is the way of the Spectre.
And that has a backup strip. Is it an Alex Nino one, maybe, or something?
Captain Fear, yeah.
It is Captain Fear by Alex Nino.
And Steve Skates. See, I remember seeing one of these stories, and it always blew my mind. I don't know if it was in this. Yeah, it was in one of these. I think Walt Simonson did some of these.
He did do some of them, yeah.
I never really knew what Captain Fear was. I read one story and that was it. This is
but
nice.
But Nino's like almost like, he's such a great artist, almost like a surrealist.
Yeah, he's really unique.
Yeah. Still around.
This is a great, okay, you won the whole contest, dude. Yeah, these, they put the spirit, the Spectre out in like four reprint books.
They did put them out, yeah, in the 80s or 90s.
But I read something. I've never seen them, but I think somebody did framing sequences to it, which to me is unnecessary.
And there was a brand, and there was a new unused, there was an unused story that they re-inked.
Was it a Parle?
An unused story. Yeah, this is nice.
Yeah, those I think we'll both say that's some of our favorite comics, is those Spectres that Jim Aparo drew. They're they're second to none. They were greatness.
Yeah.
And they were a lot different than anything else.
One more.
All right.
Let's see here. I'm going to go in the opposite direction. I'll go here. Oh, Gru. It's an oldie.
That's, I bought that, the dollar box at Yancey. I've got all the Gru issues. But what issue is that?
86? Not 86. It's from 86. It's issue 17.
That's
which is
one
an early one.
That's one of my favorite Gru issues. This, the cover, he's jumping out of the water with all these piranhas biting him. And this whole thing, he swims ashore. I'm guessing this is after he, I think it was after a ship issue, when he always sank ships. See, he swims to shore, and he gets to Pescatel and the hatchery. But he's walking by, and there's this huge, clearing, you know, it's a big, kind of like a lake, and there's a city out on it, you know, all docks and pontoons, and he walks up, and he thinks, this is a village on stilts. It is completely ringed by water. How will I get to it and its food? So he just decides to walk across. He sees a woman carrying a basket on her head, walking on the water, and he says, wait, the water's but a few inches deep. I can walk across the delicious fish. Fish, here I come. He steps in. He goes completely down, and then he jumps out with all the piranhas biting him. Man-eating fish. How do I get to the island? Then he's on the shore, and he sees the woman walking across. And when she comes to the shore, she's on stilts. You just couldn't see him, you know, because of the water line. He goes, oh.
The Marvels had him, too. There's a rectangle right
Marvels
there.
Marvels was black. Yeah, I don't know what that was.
It's got to be some kind of dates or something, like when they pull them at, you know, a certain point, up the stands or something.
You think? I always thought it was some type of guide for the printer that...
Maybe that's it. Somebody, we'll find out. Or somebody will tell us. Or nobody will ever know. That's a mystery.
I wonder if we can look it up. How would you look it up? Anyway, Gru Bill Stiltz. And he walks in his village. They're eating fish. It's a whole kingdom. There's one thing I loved about Gru. They never brought it up, but Sergio Arganez showed you. Was every place he went, they had their own culture. You know, I mean, in this one, it's an African type, but everybody's got their own clothes and dress. The ladies all dress certain ways. And but he's eating them out of house and home. He puts them in charge of the army. Again, like always, he messes everything up. He attacks one of their friendly neighboring, you know, tribes that was their allies. So they put him back on. He leads out. Everything he does is a disaster. Finally, at one point, they put him in charge. They have him work in the hatchery. And this is one of my favorite segments. He's got all these tanks full of fish in there. And right in the middle, it's open to the water, and it shows, you know, fish jumping out of it. And basically what his job is, it says he's chief controller of fluid environment level. But he's taking buckets, dipping them in the water, and then filling up the aquarium. And they show all these different kinds of fish, and finally he gets to one. It's three giant fish in one aquarium, and they look horrendous. He goes, "These fish grow too big for their homes. They will break something. I'd better rescue them into the lake. The people here will be so pleased at how alert I am." So he takes the three giant fish, throws them in the lake, and everybody freaks out. Those big fish are the only enemies of the piranha who inhibit the lake and guard Pescatel. The big fish will eat all the guard fish. So he takes away the town's protection. They kick him out. Then these other three tribes that he fought, he says, "I come from there, true, but I'm the wanderer at heart. In fact, I was just banished from Pescatel. They threw me out." And they explain to him why he eats. And he says, "Why were you made to leave Pescatel?" "Well, you see, these fish are growing too big for their homes, and..." So next thing you know, the Pescatel is trying to figure out, you know, if anybody knows the piranha's gone. Next thing you know, Gru leaves, and there's all these tribes ready to take over the town just because they let Gru in.
So that was plotted by Sergio Aragonés, but it's dialogued by Avenir, right, Mark Avenir?
Yeah, well, the way these comics worked was they would meet. They always talked about Katner's Deli in Los Angeles. They would meet there and, you know, eat, and they would plan out each issue. They talk them over, and I think usually Sergio had the idea, but I'm guessing it was both of them.
Stan Sakai did the lettering.
Yeah, always.
I didn't know that.
He lettered all of them. I think Dark Horse, some of the later ones he didn't, but he's been lettering it again. But he was always the letterer for them.
I didn't know that.
But they plotted out, and then Sergio goes, you know, writes and draws it kind of Marvel style, and then after it's finished, Mark Evanier adds all the dialogue. But the graphic novels are different. There's two Gru graphic novels. The first is called The Death of Gru, which was okay, but that was different because Mark Evanier wrote that one for full script, and then Sergio drew it. And then they did The Life of Gru, which is one of my absolute favorite Gru stories, but Mark Evanier wrote the thing full script, and Sergio drew it, but that one was genius. It was a lot better than Death of Gru. And I guess when Epic Comics put it out, they put it out in this little tiny manga-sized book. I found it at MegaCon, of all places. I got it, but it was kind of disappointing. But the one I bought in in Berkeley, California, was it was a graffiti edition. Because I showed it to a friend of mine. He goes, "Oh, yeah, I got it." And when he saw the graffiti, he goes, "Well, I don't have that one." It's, you know, it was a regular Marvel graphic novel, European size. And it's just greatness. The artwork is second to none. The story was second to none. Gru's always been, if not my favorite comic, one of my favorite comics. But Gru 17, it was always right at the top of the list.
All right, let's go for the last one.
All right, one more. We said one more, but we're going to finish it out with Al's awesome
pile. We're
going to finish
it off with an oldie goldie here.
All right, ready?
Yeah, it's an oldie goldie, man.
Oh. This is Flash 233.
Man, all DC.
Solo starring in this issue, Green Lantern.
All DC today.
This is Dr. Zoom. Is this where they killed Iris?
That's a good question. Let's find out, shall we? Okay. I don't think so.
Dr. Zoom was the reverse Flash. He wore the Flash's costume, but it was the opposite. Everything that was red on the Flash was yellow on Dr. Zoom, and everything that was yellow on the Flash was red on Dr. Zoom. I never really quite understood the story. He came from the future, and I think he had the Flash's costume. So he had the same powers.
Who is it? Who's the art by? It's not Infantino. It looks like... Irv
Novik and Ted Blaisdell.
Oh, okay.
Irv Novik drew that for a long time in the 70s.
He
75.
Sure did.
He's got a yardstick. He says, Flash, why are you twirling that yardstick like a propeller? It's my super speed murder weapon, Iris. Now that you know my secret, I've got to kill you. Jesus. Who wrote this?
Kenninger?
Carrie Bates.
Carrie
Bates wrote it for a long time. But, my text Blaisdell. His inking's bizarre. But I do know that Dr. Zoom, later on, I guess towards the late 70s or early 80s, he killed...
Did he kill Iris?
Yeah, he killed Iris. And Flash, there was a lawsuit where they were after the Flash saying he killed her. Oh, no, because he... It looked like he killed Dr. Zoom. I never read those issues. But, he was under trial, a murder trial for killing Dr. Zoom. But he didn't really.
It was usually like Giordano or Frank McLaughlin that inked those.
Yeah. Well.
Tina Tex Blaisdell, I believe he did Drew Little Orphan Annie in the in that era, yeah.
I know Tex Blaisdell around this time started doing a lot of DC work, inking.
Inking Kurt Swan and people like that.
Now here's something to tell you about what an idiot I am. I always got confused with Rook when I was talking about Mark Texiera because I always think of Tex Blaisdell. Well, they both have Tex in their name. You know, but I'm thinking he doesn't even draw like that guy, you know.
No, not at all. Is that Giordano?
No, it's Dick Dillon. Inks by Terry Austin and Dick Giordano.
Wow, Terry Austin did backgrounds probably, like robots or whatever.
Well, he was an assistant to Dick.
Giordano, everybody was.
But his name comes first.
Oh, man, look at that.
So, The World That Bet on War, the Green Lantern story. Daniel O'Neill wrote it. Oh, nice. Yeah, this is actually pretty good, but you can still tell it's Dick Dillon.
Yeah, he did a lot of backup stories. I mean, like even that adventure, you know, two backup stories and two, you know, main stories or whatever. That looks nice.
Yeah.
Adams did a few of those, I think, or at least one or something.
Some of this here, this page, looks a lot like Adams.
Yeah, it's Giordano going crazy on there.
You can tell it's still Dick Dillon, but it's got a...
It's got that feel to it.
Yeah, Neil Adams feel. Okay, that's not a bad issue at all. Yeah, it's got the On Sale Now, new from DC. It's got Claude the Unconquered, The Joker, Justice Inc.
That just is ink. Wasn't like the first issue Kirby, and then after that it was like Al McWilliams or something?
It's the opposite. The first issue, that was about the Avenger from the Pulp book. But the first issue was drawn by that guy, and it fascinated me.
Al McWilliams,
and then the second issue and all the rest were Jack Kirby.
Okay, it was the opposite.
That's when after they canceled the Fourth World books, and Jack Kirby was doing OMAC, and he was doing Justice Inc., and he was doing The Losers.
Sandman,
he did,
I think. The Losers.
Yeah, Sandman.
What was that one that he did, the Dingbats of something?
Yeah, that was the first issue.
First issue special, yeah.
That was, I wanted to like it. I remember my friend.
I know.
My friend liked Inferior 5.
I loved Inferior 5.
I did too. And so he was talking about Dingbats, thinking it was going to be like Inferior 5, but I found it kind of dreadful myself.
Well, you know, it was kind of like Kirby was kind of like, okay, you know, I'm just going to pull out some old characters that I had floating around. Let's see what happens.
Well, he always loved kid gangs, they say. And, you know, he always did the Boy Commandos, Boys Ranch. There was a bunch of Newsboy Legion.
Yeah.
And those old books were kind of neat at the time, but, you know, there was no kid gangs anymore except violent gangs that didn't really have so many kids.
Yeah, exactly. The Warriors. Well, all right, man. We went through a lot of stuff.
Anyway, I guess that's about all we got. Dallas will come on in a minute and tell you everything else that's available. Thanks for listening. If you could, give us a rating or iTunes review. It helps other people find us. And in the meantime,
read more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go-Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!